This is a Pinball News production.
Well, the title of my talk is going to be DE and Sega Pinball, Dave East and Sega Pinball, Fact or Fiction. And what I'm going to do for my talk is, well, for a little while I'm going to talk about just sort of what we did, how our teams were together, design teams. And then I'm going to start going through some stories that I have of times before I was at Dead East, things that I've heard that you probably all haven't heard, and then things that happened at Dead East and Sega. And try and sort of make it fun that I'll give you a statement and ask fact or fiction, and have you guys vote that everybody thinks it's true, can raise their hands. I'll call it for fact, and I'll call it for fiction. Everybody else can raise their hands, and then I'll tell you if it's true or not, and maybe a story about it. So the one thing I'd ask is that when I do, don't shout out the answer, because that spoils it for everybody. Some of you may have heard these stories from me before. I see some familiar faces out there. So the big thing about Dave East and Sega was teamwork. That as one company, we were really all one team. That Williams was maybe a little bit competitive, and there were particular design teams that would work together as a group, but maybe they wouldn't cross teams so much. We weren't as big. Williams was making maybe 8 games a year in the early 90s. The Valley game, the Williams game, they were on 2 at once. And we were making 4 games a year, not nearly the numbers that they were making. Still very good for a small company. But we'd have a designer, and then we would have other people pretty much come into the mix and help out just wherever they could. If you look at one of our typical design teams, we'd have a lead mechanical engineer who would typically get credited as the game designer, but they wouldn't necessarily do all the rules. That game designer might not be a mechanical engineer. He might have somebody like Joe Camico being the game designer. He didn't draw stuff except for, on the back of a napkin. So then there'd be a mechanical engineer who would be sort of the lead guy for that. Then there'd be other supporting mechanical engineers. Somebody would say, I need somebody to draw this assembly or that assembly or this toy, put that together. So we'd have a mechanical team that would be, anywhere from 2 to 4 people on a game. Then we'd have a game programmer who would basically be the guy who was in charge of doing the CPU system. Now, we're a little bit different from Williams in that we have separate systems for the game, for the dot matrix display, and also for the sound. That they were sort of slaves to the game. The game would say, okay, show me this display with this parameters, or play this sound right now. It was really sort of modular. It was kind of neat that programmer could be working on something. Display programmer had his own code over here working on that. We had Brian Schmidt, who was living up in Evanston and doing all the sounds, and then we would put it all together. So we'd have a game programmer and maybe another person who would step in and write a little bit of game code. Display programmer who do the dot matrix. Usually that was just one person. Sound programmer and composer, that was Brian Schmidt for all of the Dead East games and most of the Sega games until he took a job at Microsoft. Dot matrix artists who would do all the digital effects, hand that over to the display programmer, and the display programmer would put it into the game and make all the animations play and everything. Then we have game artists who at Dead East, there were no in-house game artists. It was always somebody who worked as a contractor, somebody like Paul Ferris, Marcus Rothkranz, who'd draw the art, bring it in or ship it to us. We'd go back and forth with changes, ship it to, it was a licensed thing, which of course it almost always was at Dead East, ship it out to the movie studio or whoever owned the property, and they would have changes, and then go back to the artist, back to us. Some of those backlots probably had enough miles to get a free flight going back and forth to California and so forth. And then we also had folks that designed the cable, that did the bill of material. The bill of material was critical, that we had to know how much we were going to spend to do a game. That you couldn't just say, okay, well, I want this to be the game, and then be able to put it all together, and you don't want to say, well, gee, my game costs $2,700. Oops, distributor cost is going to be $1,800. So for every game that we make, we're going to, excluding labor, lose $800. We're going to let that happen. So we had to keep keep a sharp eye on what's coming into our games, not just for profits, but also so that we could build the game. You know, we need to have enough parts on hand to do a run. Then we also had the folks that did the manual. That changed over time, too. That if you have an old Danish manual and then take a look at anything from, say, Guns N' Roses onward, you can see the big difference from when J. Alfred joined Dave East and really overhauled the manual. Then we had other, of course, engineering was not the whole company. We had other really important parts, production and factory being first and foremost. That, you can design a game, but if you can't build it, then nobody's ever going to see it. Purchasing, getting all the parts, the vendors that we worked really closely with, getting mechanical parts and sub-assemblies, getting the play field and the cabinet done, our tech support group, and, of course, sales, marketing, and all that. So what came first when we went to design a game? Would you have a license first, where you wanted to say, okay, I want to make a game that's going to be Guns N' Roses? Or would you have a layout? You say, I've got this playfield and I want it, and I want this to be the next game. Or would you have a toy? It's like, well, I've got this really cool, mechanical engineer says, I've got this really cool way to interact with the ball. And I want to do a game with it. Well, yeah, any of those might happen, and frequently did. But, you might design something and say, okay, well, we got this great toy. Let's go out and get a license so that we can... so that we could use it. Or you might have an assembly like the gravestone that was on Tales from the Crypt. The Tommy license came along, and it was the next game. It's like, gee, that'd be great for a mirror. And, then write a game. So, my time at Data East and Sega to Stern. I started in 1993 in December. And it's sort of an interesting story how I started. That I think it was October of 1993, Dave East did Tommy. They really did a great job in starting with that Tommy license and getting those prototype games out. I don't know if any of you have seen those prototype games, a different layout from the final play field to Michael Hampton's not even say because he has one. When they debuted that game, they debuted it at the Hard Rock Cafe down in Dallas. And it was October of 1993. And they brought it out at that time because the Tommy show on Broadway was going off Broadway and actually started its tour in Dallas. So that was the perfect place to do sort of a premiere for the game. It's like a media publicity event. And they're doing it at the Hard Rock Cafe. And they wanted somebody who was really good at pinball to come and demonstrate the game, for the press and everybody, help run a tournament. And of course, the obvious choice was Lionel Sheets because he had started working at Data East probably, 6 or 7 months before. But Lyman was going to Spain to play in a pinball tournament that week. So they were looking for somebody to do it. He was a really good pinball player. And they couldn't find anybody, so it ended up being me. I emailed with Joe Camco and Lonnie Rock, and I happened to be able to get to Dallas that weekend. I was working for NASA at the time, and I was on a business trip to Huntsville. So I thought it'd be a real easy thing to just hop in the car and drive to Dallas, not realizing it was like 10 hours. But, I did it. And I met them. I met Joe Kamica, Lonnie Roth, Joe Blackwell. Joe Balser was there too, Jim Gorman. Met them all at the Hard Rock Cafe and just had a great time. It was really fun. And I always wanted to do pinball, so I brought him a resume. I was a programmer, and didn't really think very much of it. I was actually back here. Chicago was originally my home. I was back here visiting, like the next weekend for Columbus Day or something. It's nice being a government employee, getting those sort of fake holidays off that only school kids get otherwise. And went by there. I met Neil Falconer and Christina Donfrio. Saw some of their Whitewoods, saw the Whitewood for Tales from the Crypt, and really hit it off with them really well. But they had three or four programmers, and that was pretty much what they had. And there's no jobs, so it's like okay. So I went back to work, and about a month later, Lonnie Rock posts an ad to Rick Ames Pinball. It's like Data East is looking for programmers. And I took a look at the requirements, and it's like, you need this, about assembly language, and, have this background. you know, I was a programmer, but I didn't really have any of it. My background was math and physics. I had done assembly language since junior high school. I'm like, well, you know, I'm not going to apply. So about a week later, I get a call from Lonnie. He's like, you can apply for the job. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't think I've got the requirements that you're asked for. He's like, well, you should apply anyway. So I did, and got a call from Joe a week ago, and had an interview, I guess, a couple days before Thanksgiving in 1993. And we talked to a lot of people in the company, went out to lunch, and made me a job offer at lunch down at Sorrento's down at Mannheim Road, which is where it seemed like we ended up having a lot of our design meetings over lunch, too. And offered me the job, and I accepted it. Kevin Martin interviewed for a job there that afternoon, the other job that afternoon, and accepted it on the same day. It was really interesting the circumstances why there were two jobs open that sort of around Halloween, Joe and Lonnie were meeting, and they decided that they wanted to expand the programming department. And while they're having that meeting, Christina walked to the door, knocked on the door, came in and said, I want to spend more time with my family, I'm resigning. So while they were talking about making one job, all of a sudden they had two openings. So it was really easy for both of us to slip in. Like I said, Lonnie Ropp and Neil Falconer were there. They were the two, after Christina left, they were the two lead game programmers. John Carpenter was also there. He did display. Lionel Sheets was there doing display. And then we added, added me and Kevin. So we had six people there as programmers. So like I said, I started December 93, and I was actually there as a programmer through June of 1998. And at that time, Sega owned the company. They were having, the pinball company was having financial problems. Sega was having financial problems. And they're like, well, we need to cut back. So they had to reduce the headcount. I was under contract. Basically I got a settlement where not only did I get a little bit of severance, but they immediately hired me back as a contractor for more money. And I could move to North Carolina and get married. So it was really a win-win situation. When I was down there, I programmed The End of Lost in Space, programmed Godzilla, programmed South Park, a couple novelty games, all that from down there. And that came to an end in February of 99. Joe left to go to IGT. They thought they might want to get some new blood, some in-house people. They hired somebody who programmed Harley. And after Harley, that person decided that the future was with the internet, not with the programming 6809 assembly language. So he quit. And they didn't have anybody. They were getting ready to hire me on to do Striker Extreme. And then, does anybody know what happened 8 years ago today?
Oh, Williams closed.
Williams closed. Black Monday is the anniversary of Black Monday. So, at that point, they said, well, we can get a lot of people, but we don't think we can get them up to speed quick enough to do a game. So I went ahead and did Striker anyway. Since I knew Striker and I had the time, they kept me on to do NFL, the NFL games, the custom games that they based on Striker, basically because they couldn't sell enough Strikers to get rid of all the parts. It was a great way to, you know, if you can't sell a game for $2,000, why don't you redeem it and try and sell it for $4,500? So that was a great project to be in. I did that all as sort of moonlighting, that I had a regular job down in North Carolina, and then I'd come home and spent a couple hours doing dot matrix, and you know, by then it was old hat. I think I programmed something like 17 dot matrix games while I was there in the span of about 5 years. So it was really, really sort of streamlined stuff and changed their systems enough that that I could really do it quickly. Then I got laid off from a job down in North Carolina around the time PLD was getting started. And Lonnie called me and said, you know, we need somebody to do display. Do you want to do display for Monopoly? I'm like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that. I'd love to have that be a full-time job again. But Pat decided he wanted somebody in-house, so we hired Greg Dunlap, who was looking for work. And that was a great decision. Greg did a great job at PLD. And I sort of said, well, I guess I'm done with pinball. I got another real job. Well, then they called and said, well, we don't have enough programmers. Lyman's busy working on the new system. We need somebody to do the dot matrix on Playboy. Are you interested? Do you want to work with Dwight? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'd love to work with Dwight. It was great. I'd never had a chance to do anything with him before. So I did that game from North Carolina, moonlighting, while I had yet another different day job. And to date, that's the most recent game that I've done. But you know, I'm always waiting for the call to come. So, I think with the new system, that's probably not going to happen. I can probably, if I ever get those, if I ever have any free time, maybe I'll get to working on home runs for some of those old Sega games. So that's pretty much my history. And now I'm going to go into the fact or fiction part. I guess I did advance the slide there by accident. That was my when I moved down to North Carolina, that was my badge that Jay Alfer made me for Expo in, I believe, 2001 when Monopoly was the game. So everybody else was like Park Place or Boardwalk, whatever. I said, no, I need to be North Carolina Avenue because that's where I live now. So we did it that way. Yeah. So I've got kind of three sections here, and I'm not sure how long this is going to take. I started writing down all the things that I knew, all the stories that I knew about Data East. I was doing this over the course of a few weeks, and thought of some more on the plane when I was on the way here. And by the time I got to like 10 pages of longhand stories, where they're just talking points, bullet points, I realized that I was only all the way up to the first game that I programmed, which is Guns N' Roses. So, I don't know if this stuff is going to be boring or not, but it's a lot of stuff that's sort of, corporate secrets that would not be subject to a non-disclosure agreement that I'm still under. So just sort of interesting things that happen. There's things in the factory that happened that, people in engineering might not have known about at the time. Things that happen in engineering, licensing, all kinds of stuff like that. So, section one, which is entitled Before My Time. So fact or fiction. During the European run of Data East Checkpoint, the factory ran out of Porsche Matchbox cars. To keep production going, they went across the street to a discount store and bought any red toy car that they could find, including VW Bugs. Who says fact? Who says fiction? About half and half. That is fact. That is something that Joe Kamenko does not know. He does not know that they took his baby and they put VW Bugs on it and shipped it off to Europe where you never see it. But they, they had trucks waiting. They had, they were making a good number of games a day. They were not going to hold it up because they couldn't get the right model of Matchbox car. So, okay. Here's another one. Fact or fiction. On Data East Checkpoint, another early 128x16 dot matrix games from Data East. The dot matrix art was created digitally by artists and programmers. Fact? Fiction. Okay, everybody must know the story. They did it on graph paper. They took a pencil and they drew the art, and then they had somebody else who was doing data entry who was writing with zeros and ones, typing the zeros and ones into a computer, and that made the bitmap image. And it was easy to do because that art really wasn't very shaded. It was pretty much one color. It was on or off. So you guys know that story. Okay. Fact or fiction? A Batman Returns conversion kit was designed for the original Batman pinball game. Fact? Fiction. Well, it was designed. It was never produced. So that is fact. They had the art, basically an overlay, a Mylar overlay that would change some of the playfield, and they also had a different ramp that would go in the middle. They had a plastic. Last I saw, it was up in the attic at the old factory at 1990 Janus Avenue. They had a ramp, and they had pencil sketches of the art, and it never actually got to production. But yeah, they were all set to do it, and. Joel Silver was on board. He was really hot to have in their game because he loved that Batman game. Okay. Fact or fiction. During Lethal Weapon 3, when Joe Kamenko got a hairpiece, when he came back to the office, the whole engineering department was wearing mops on their heads. Fact? Fiction. It is true. It's a good hairpiece, but... it's also a good job. Fact or fiction. In the early 1990s, during the week of Easter, the Data East factory was evacuated when workers on the line start passing out from a noxious smell. Who says fact? Who says fiction? It is fact that they had all these factory workers that were passing out. You know, TV was there, hazmat was there, they're trying to figure out what was going on. It turned out that a lot of the workers were Catholic, and they were fasting before Easter. And they all passed out. And since then, and I believe this continues, that week before Easter, before the fasting starts, they have a sweet table at the factory. They make cake and cookies and donuts and all kinds of stuff so that these folks get all energized. So the next day when they come to work at the factory, they have anything to eat, they don't all pass out. Okay, here's another one. Fact or fiction? The custom Joel Silver pinball, created by Data East and based on Data East's Star Trek 25th anniversary, features William Shatner saying, "You, me, and the hooker." Who says fact? Who says fiction? That is actually fiction because that's a quote from the Aaron Spelling Game. So, of course, referring to T.J. Hooker, which Aaron Spelling produced for William Shatner as a star. Okay, fact or fiction? That same Joel Silver game rethemed the dilithium crystals of Star Trek as movie popcorn. Who says fact? Okay, who says fiction? That is actually a fact. That's what it was themed as. So you'd hit the switches and it'd make a popcorn popping sound. You fill up the popcorn bowl. A little bit newer stuff. We're done with the 128 by 16 dot themes. Fact or fiction? The custom Michael Jordan pinball based on Lethal Weapon 3 featured gunshots when the basketball targets were hit. Who says fact? Who says fiction? That is actually fact. That there wasn't the sound effect never got changed and we hit the basketball targets. That one was done pretty quickly. So. There were people have asked about it. During Lethal Weapon 3 and Star Wars, demand for Data East pinball was so high that additional second and third shifts were required to complete the production run. Who says fact? And who says fiction? That is fiction. That they managed out of that little factory to make a couple hundred games a day, which was amazing. This is running that factory with so many people, and of course we're talking about a bathroom, men's bathroom that had two urinals and two stalls, and you know, 5 minute break to go to the bathroom. That was absolutely amazing. Now if you want to talk about factories that did have second and third shifts, you can think about Valley during Ms. Pac-Man. That I've heard a lot of stories about that video game. That you know, when they're making 120,000 missed packs, that they'd be cranking out games, you know, shoving them onto the trucks as soon as quickly as they could come pick it up, you know, to get this game out before video crashes. If they knocked a game onto the ground off the loading dock during that run and it fell on the ground, they wouldn't even go clean it up until the end of the day. They wouldn't even care. They just said, okay, get another game out there, fill up that truck, and get it out. The only other good second and third shift story that I know is a really old Valley story. If anybody knows who Jim Ross is, he was the director of purchasing at Data East for many years, and before that he was at Valley. He was at Valley, I think, long enough to get either three or four diamonds in his Valley ring. Each one was 10 years. It was there a long time. When he was working in production, they would, just when Valley was making pinballs or bingos, they would actually finish the pinball line production, you know, 4 o'clock, and then they would bring out 8 or 10 ball bowler cabinets, and they'd build the ball bowlers at night. They'd bring out these 8 or 10 cabinets, and they would have to finish each one of those ball bowlers by morning. So it was like start to finish. You got to do these games, or they're going to be in the way, and we can't produce pinball. So, but we never did. We never did any second, third shift. Well, at least the factory didn't. I mean, I was there all night playing time. So were other engineering people. Fact or fiction? The Rocky and Bullwinkle pinball game features an Easter egg display effect where Joe Camico and Bullwinkle swap snot.
Who says fact? And who says fiction? It is fiction. The display effect exists, but it's not in the game. So I wish I had a graphic. I do not. Maybe next time. All right. Fact or fiction? The control room switch on Jurassic Park was very troublesome. That and the dinosaur were big problems. Fact or fiction? The control room failure on Jurassic Park was caused by one factory worker who did not solder the diode to the subassembly properly. Who says fact? Who says fiction? That is fact. It was one person who basically disabled 3,000 Mostars by having a cold. He was very consistent. He had the same cold solder joint on every single game. So I finally figured it out, but it was a cold solder joint, so it really didn't break until the game was in the field and had a few hundred plays on it. And that game got a lot of play at first. So that was Jurassic was one of the few games that actually coincided with the movie release in the U.S. It really helped sales. The French, on the other hand, they had no idea what Jurassic Park was. And by the time the movie came out there, it was an enormous hit. All the games were already sold. They sold in the U.S. They wanted more games, and it's like, you know, too bad. We're already halfway through Last Action here on them. So, you know, that sort of demonstrates the wonderful ability of Stern to go back and make any model at any time in these short runs that back then was never considered. It's like, you know, nobody's ever done this. We couldn't possibly do it. You got to make one game and then move on. Okay, fact or fiction? The prototype Tommy pinball machines were first shown only 6 weeks after Data East started work on the project. Who says fact? And who says fiction? That is fact, that they went from license to having 10 finished games in 6 weeks. That was an absolutely amazing feat of engineering. They cranked those guys out, got the playfield design, got all the plastic parts, all the plastics, playfield screens, everything. And then another 6 weeks, they did it again because the game changed. Okay. Fact or fiction? So we're getting into the questions that start when I started at Data East. Fact or fiction? At Data East, every new programmer or engineer had to spend at least 1 week in the factory helping with the launch of a game, doing quality control and quality assurance. Who says fact? Who says fiction? Yeah, that's a fact. Yeah, that was really good. I don't know if they still do it. We sort of stopped doing it at Sega, and I think we slipped a little bit. There were people that were making stuff that the factory had no chance of putting together. Our factory was a little different than Williams. Williams had a lot of longtime employees, and Williams did too. But Williams had a little bit more union labor. It was people who were, you know, coming back, getting paid a little bit better, and really sort of do their stuff, whereas we had a lot more turnover. It's really hard to keep people in those manufacturing jobs. Fact or fiction? Oops, that must be a right click. Ha! Fact or fiction? There's your Tommy back glass. That's from my basement from my game. The production Tommy back glass in Playfield had bolder colors than the prototype because some European customers thought that the game was too effeminate. Who says fact? Who says fiction? That is actually a fact. I'm going to go ahead and advance it. There's the prototype glass. You see there's all these light blues, purple. They really didn't like it. Same reason that they made Rocky and Bullwinkles for Germany with black cabinets, if you've ever seen one of those, instead of the light blue cabinet. It was exactly the same reason they said that. That's not a manly color. Of course, being a dude person, that color is University of North Carolina. Makes me laugh. So. Alright, here's another question about the prototype Tommy. Fact or fiction, mechanical chimes were removed from the prototype Tommy because the parts that they needed to mass produce for those games were no longer available and they were too expensive to retool. Who says fact? Who says fiction? It is fiction. That all those parts were still available, chime units were real simple. It was just too expensive overall. There was no retooling. There was a lot of cost reduction between the prototype Tommy and the real game that changed ramps around. I went from some plastic ramps to some metal ramps, dropped the feature where the bomber could drop the ball down into the play field. It had six pop bumpers. The production one only had three. Replace three pop bumpers with a captain ball. That would really save money. Fact or fiction? Another European customer was very upset that this prototype back glass was eliminated. And as a result, they reproduced this original back glass for the games that that customer ordered. Who says fact? Fiction? It's fact. It was actually done for a Scandinavian country. But they really wanted that back glass, and the guy said, I'll order a container of games, but only if I get that back glass. So we still had the screens and were able to quickly crank them out. And in fact, if we had done that, then I wouldn't have that back glass sitting on the wall of my basement stairs. So we're done with Tommy. And WWF. Fact or fiction? The WWF art was redone after a steroid scandal with the WWF. Who says true? Who says fact? And who says fiction? It's fact that there was this back glass where we had that Paul Ferris had originally done. We had all these guys with these big ripped, 24-pack muscles on their chest and all this, and they got busted, and it all had to be redone. And actually, that's why the back glass part of that game is not Paul Ferris art; it's Marcus Rothkrantz art. That Paul was finally sick of it. He wouldn't do another back glass. He already had to do three or four back glasses because people quit WWF, had to redo the back glass without this wrestler or that wrestler. And it actually marked the beginning of a rift between Dave East and Paul that we didn't end up using him for a number of games. We brought in some new people to do the art, and I think the next game that he did may have been Twister. So I'm talking about six or seven games for a guy that was pretty much regular doing. Maybe every other game. Okay. Fact or fiction? The original WWF pinball, as designed, was an ultra-wide pinball game like the classic ballet games, Paragon, but it was reduced in size when Williams came out with Twilight Zone. Who says fact? Okay. Who says fiction? It is fiction. The original WWF was narrow body. And then when Williams came out with a popular white wood, we said, okay, let's see how we can make this wider. The new play field got added and made some changes. So WWF probably went through the most changes of any game that I've probably seen at Data East. Fact or fiction? All Data East games in 1994 produced for Japan had a shaker motor. Fact? Fiction. It is fiction, but only because of Tommy. And then the whole story stems from Tommy, too. That around 1994, 95, countries were starting to have much stricter import requirements. That Europe had the CE mark for different testing. And Japan, for some reason, said, well, if you're going to sell a product, it has to contain the same number of motors the whole year. And of course, we had four models a year. And here we come with Tommy, the first game of the year for these new restrictions. And it's got a bunch of motors in it. It's got the fan motor. It's got the motor that raises and lowers the mirror. It's got the two little propeller motors in the airplane, so those could spin. So every game we made for Japan had to have four motors in it. So we're putting in fans in like weird places and stuff just so we can sell the game. But we didn't add anything as expensive as a shaker motor. Because that'd be like $60 when you can put in a fan for like 55 cents. That's what we have to do. Anything to sell games. Fact or fiction? Data East programmer Lonnie Robb's voice appears in WWF. Who says fact? Okay. Who says fiction? No, he only started saying all that WWF stuff after the game came out. I don't think he stopped yet. So it became a big inside joke to say, "Oh, yeah!" All that kind of stuff that you can't avoid if you're in the same room as that game. You're going to hear that stuff over and over and over and over again. Okay. Fact or fiction? Bad luck for Dave East. Hulk Hogan left WWF during the first week that WWF was in production. Then Guns N' Roses broke up immediately before the production of Guns N' Roses started. Who says fact? Who says fiction? That is fact. Both of those things happened. We felt so snake bit that we've gone for 3 years putting people on that back glass, taking them off, changing their muscles, and then the big guy, Hulk Hogan, who's right in the center of it, quits just as the game is going into production. So probably would have been a failure anyway, but you know, all the wrestling fans immediately knew that it was immediately and forever knew that it was a whole game. And it was a big deal. I guess if you're a wrestling fan, you might know we kind of won. Fact or fiction? Data East designers got special games from the factory as part of their contracts. Who says fact? Okay. Who says fiction? It is fiction. They would take this wonderful plaque and they would slap it on the crappiest test game that they had, and that's what they sent home with us.
That's a special design.
Joe was, it was specially designed. I'm going to tell you exactly how specially designed my Guns N' Roses was. It's actually kind of funny. But I've got another one here. Fact or fiction? The original design of Guns N' Roses called for a spinner in the right orbit and a drop target guarding the add band member lane block ball shot. Who says fact? Who says fiction? Okay. That is, technically that is fiction. There was a spinner in the game. There was a right spinner. If anybody's familiar with Guns N' Roses, there's a mode in there called Slash Solo. And that was a spinner mode. There was a spinner in the right orbit, and you hit the spinner and you had to get a certain number of spins to make Slash play a solo. You know, you start to hit the spinner and you'd be on his guitar and this play going crazy. Anyway, we had a complaint from Gary that there wasn't enough pop-bumper action in the game, that he couldn't sell games in Europe unless there were pop-bumpers. And he thought that shot at the right loop needed to be wider. It used to go all the way around. But as a result of what Gary said we had to do, we made the right orbit wider, and we didn't have a spinner that was wide enough to fill it in and couldn't retool. So the spinner came out, and we put a one-way gate up at the top so that right shot went to the pop bumpers. We did have a drop target in the game, but it was really, really easy to make that lock shot. So we figured, well, we got to have a drop target so we can keep you guys from getting 12 multi-balls a game. But it was really funny. We made the orbit wider. We made that orbit wider, and that meant that the add bend number shot got narrower. You couldn't really backhand it very well anymore. So the problem fixed itself. But on one game, we actually cut out a slot in that lane and had a single resettable drop target. And then took that drop target out. And wouldn't you know, that's the game that I got. They took a piece of wood, and they pounded it down into the hole, and it was right in the middle of one of the girls, right in the middle of her leg, you know, sort of the scantily clad girls that are there. So whoever did it restored the game by taking a black magic marker and drawing the outlines of her legs, and they put a Mylar patch over it. The other thing that happened to my game was it had a headphone jack on it, that 50 Guns N' Roses games were made for Europe with a headphone jack. And they tested the prototype headphone jack on my game. So, wouldn't you know it, when they took that game and they took the headphone jack out of it, patched the front of the cabinet with Bondo, painted it black, and wouldn't you know it went to me. You know, I would have liked to have had a headphone jack. I wouldn't have minded having the drop target either. But instead, it was sort of this hack-up game. So, I don't still have it anymore. But I do still have the plaque. That I actually took that picture the other day. It's sitting on top of the glass of my Monopoly right now. Fact or fiction? The original design of Guns N' Roses called for metallic finish G and R ramps rather than the plastic ramps that were in the game. Who says fact? Okay, fiction? It's fiction. It would have been great if we could have, because those plastic ramps break, especially that G ramp, if we had a little stability with some metal in it. Probably would have been harder to see the pop bumper stuff, so Gary probably would never have gone for it. Okay, so that is the end of Data East. We're all the way into Sega now. What's the time check?
5 minutes or so.
Okay, all
right,
well, maybe we'll come back next year. Okay, so let's see.
When did your NDA expire?
When I died.
Oh, all right.
So, you know, really the only thing I can't talk about is production numbers. I can't come out here and start putting up source code on the screen. Probably the pin name. Probably the pin name people will probably know it already. So I'll just look at the comments. So, big dot matrix display in Sega. That was the big change that happened. While I was working on Guns N' Roses, doing dot matrix display on the first game that I was really sort of the lead programmer on, we've got Lyman sitting in the back room writing the operating system for the 192x64 display. Mm-hmm. Motorola 68000, going from a 20-year-old technology to 10-year-old technology. It was pretty hot. So here's a fact or fiction. Fact or fiction. The Maverick placed on test at Dennis's Place for Games in September of 1994 had a wide-body playfield and a 128x32 dot matrix display. Who says fact? Fiction? It is fact. That we actually thought Maverick was going to be a wide-body, and the market was changing. Our customers said, okay, you've done two wide-bodies, the novelty is over. We want to go back to having regular games. So we had a whole Maverick playfield laid out, and we didn't really use the wide body very effectively. Had a paddle, but a question?
There were two Dennis's at one point. Which one were you using?
It was the one out in the suburbs.
Lawrence and Cumberland and North.
Yeah.
The others at the subway tracks in Belmont.
Yeah, it was Lawrence and Cumberland. The one if you ever fly out of O'Hare at night and go the right way, you can see the neon lights. That's where it was, and we actually put it out there so that the folks from Williams, who already knew, wouldn't know that we were bringing the big display to the show. We wanted everybody to think that it was going to be wide body and 128x32. Nothing's really changed. So put that out there for a while. It was really probably the worst game that we ever put on a test. I think whenever you knocked down a drop target, it said multi-ball ready when it wasn't, because multi-ball wasn't actually in the game yet. But it was terrible. The interesting thing is that those 128x32 cards actually did resurface. When we did Starship Troopers, when we did the psychic test, the one where you have to guess which card it is for the match, I actually pulled those cards from the old Maverick display. Another question?
The Norwich police got complaints about the Dennis's in Norwich that it was attracting the wrong crowd. So they set up an observation there and concluded that it was not attracting the wrong crowd.
Okay. Well, that's good. So it attracted some quarters, but not a lot.
Well, he was open very late, I guess. Was one thing that the police didn't want.
Yeah, that's something a lot of people did like, that they could go play pinball somewhere else, and then it would, they could go play it then. I think they had a 4-AM license or something like that. So you usually don't see that outside of the city, but I think that's right. Okay. The fact or fiction, the original Maverick design, the wide-body design, featured an ace in the hole shot with an under trough underneath the paddle boat. Fact? Fiction. It's cliche, but it actually did. There was an ace in the hole shot. So we had that shot there. In that wide body game, the paddle boat was about this wide and probably about 50% slower than the production one. So maybe it's a good job that we actually went to the narrow body game. One of the things that we did sort of change in terms of design, and Guns N' Roses sort of led us to it, is that our games, you know, attracted the average player or the casual player. If people would see the license, they'd come up and play it. They might not be, you know, real serious pinball enthusiasts like all of you are. One thing Guns N' Roses did was it didn't have any undertruss under the play field. That it had one hole, and if the ball went in the hole, in that that axle hole, that mystery hole, center of the play field, it came right back out. That it wasn't, you know, sort of like Twilight Zone, where the ball would go in one place, and then go through here, and then go underneath, and come out over here. We got a lot of compliments on Guns N' Roses from our operators that said, you know, this is real simple. People know where the ball is going to go. We really like it. So when we redid Maverick to be narrow body, we got rid of that kind of thing. And we really tried to keep the ball up and play through a little bit more from then on. Yeah. Fact or fiction? The original design for Maverick featured hand-painted Lauren Bell butts. Who says fact? Fiction? It is fiction. But they do exist. During that game, I think the first 100 games, one of our artists actually had to hand paint all these little books just like this because the decals hadn't come in. So we had somebody who was normally pushing dots or something like that who had to paint 100 of these books. So I don't know exactly how I ended up with it. I've got a Maverick game stashed back in the corner of my garage, so I'll probably have to put that on there. I'll probably have to reinforce it too. I imagine that probably most of these are going to be in pieces. I'll do one more about Maverick. Fact or fiction? Maverick was the last game to feature Data East cabinet art. Who says fact? Fiction? When Sega finally took over Data East, and they'd always, for many, many years, had owned 25% of the company. They basically bought out the rest. When they took over, we'd already done 8 Frankenstein back boxes. And of course, the back box always used to say, you know, Data East across the bottom or the top and have that logo. We already had 8 of them, and we couldn't redo them. So we had this premiere to do. It was a real fancy-dancy thing. That was the world premiere of Frankenstein in Century City. They had an 8-screen cinema, and it was all 8 screens that were all Frankenstein. It was a big benefit dinner, and the tickets were, you know, $500 a piece. Prince Charles was the big speaker. It was the benefit, some sort of LA and UK charity alliance or something like that. So we came with these games, and even though they said Sega in the display, like Maverick actually said Sega in the display too. I think we had a 4.0 ROM that changed around some stuff and actually had Sega in there. We had Data East on the side and Sega on the dots. It went pretty good, though that Frankenstein was a little different. One more question.
Fact or fiction, the first batch of Maverick machines had a problem whereby the boat whistle kept sounding repeatedly.
Yeah, that's a fact. The optos were messed up.
I knew that. Those prototypes.
That was actually a great Joe Blackwell fix. That it turned out that for some reason the motor that was down underneath the boat was actually creating some sort of electrical interference in the game that would mess with the optos. And he put some sort of diode across the motor terminals and it fixed it. So it's great. It was nothing. You know, we were saying we got bad optos. You know, it's just interesting the amount of trouble we might have. Well, you know, I think I'm going to open up to questions if anybody has any. I've gotten sort of through. We got to have two things about Sega, so I guess the title isn't a complete sham. So it was mostly database. So Rob has a question.
Fact or fiction, did Joe Capcom ever design a game for the NES?
For who?
Joe Capcom.
No. Designed for who?
Did he ever design a game for the NES?
From beginning to end? You mean, did he do all the drawings and everything? No, he wasn't a mechanical engineer.
Just so. On the napkins, as far as
you know. Pretty much so. And, you know, Joe and I designed some novelty games that were just about beginning to end. So that's something to talk about for another day. So, question back here, Michael.
Can you tell us about Trouble Recall?
Can I tell you about Total Recall? I don't know all that much about Total Recall. That, if I remember right, Tim Seckel, who was a designer with us, and then later left and went to Gottlieb Premier, he designed that game sort of as a summer project. He was a student at the University of Kansas, and he applied to Joe for an internship. He came and was an intern, and he always wanted to design a two-player pinball. And Joe said, okay, well, you're an intern. We're not paying you anything. Go do it. So he did. And you know, that's what got done. You know, that it was, I don't think there was really ever software for it. There was something sort of there, but you know, nobody really intensely programmed it. But, you know, that game was always up there, and you'd always see it. You know, it's at the back of the factory up there, like this, you know, big, you know, person doing a handstand and a split sitting up there. And, you know, most people didn't know what it was. I think probably some people. Did anybody ever see that game sitting up there when they came on a factory tour?
Oh, it's not their name.
Well,
it's in the hands of the collector.
Okay, well,
I
know it's not there now because they don't have the building anymore. So that was in 1994.
What happened to Mad Magazine, the Mad Pinball?
What happened to the Mad Pinball? We never had that license. Never really had that license. So we sort of, there was that, there was the Mad Head, which really looked more like Joe's son David than Alfred and Newman. And, you know, they made the patches, they really thought that they were going to do it. But, no, there was never even a play field for that game. You know, it was sort of the classic thing, you know, let's go rip off Funhouse. So, question in the back, Sergio. How many other games were there? Well, there were quite a few in the Sega years that where there were play fields that didn't make it. And I'm going to, you know, I've got like five or six things about that. But, you know, there were a good number. There weren't games that actually got art done, really, or play fields that didn't make it. But there were Whitewood games that people designed that, you know, said, well, I want this game to be for that theme. And, you know, the rest of us are like, no, that sucks. That can never be that theme. that doesn't speak to that theme. It's just this play field that people designed. So that sort of goes back to, you know, there's the play, what comes first, the play field or the theme. So, you know, sometimes you can shoot on a toy in there and, you know, all of a sudden, hey, look, you know, it's Jurassic Temple. So, any more questions? Way in the back. Who came up with Deathball 2000? Oh, that's a great story. That happened just before I was there. There was actually an article in the Weekly World News about a pinball machine that would electrocute people if you didn't get a high score. Called Deathball 2000. And we said, gee, yeah, we should make that. So, so Joe commissioned Marcus Rothkranz, who was an artist who was out in California, to do that art. And it seemed like Marcus was an interesting character. Around the time, maybe the 2 or 3 weeks before April 15th, he would go out looking for work really, really urgently. So he could pay his taxes. He was self-employed. And I think that was actually one of those things that happened around that time. I made about 10 backlashes. Sadly, I do not have one. I think Lonnie has one. I think Joe Kamiko has one. I think Lyman has one. You know, just as a joke, before the Expo tour, I don't remember what year it was, 94, 95, we put that out in the factory on our pop-up or test fixture. We covered it up with cardboard. I mean, you know, the first bus was getting there at 9:30. We were, like, taping it up at 9:15. You know, we were lucky that the size of that backglass wasn't right for our games that we were producing. But neither was a test fixture, because the test fixture was also done for the old small dot matrix.
So one thing about Joe Kamiko and Sega and Dead East was the fact that they supported the Expo more than any factory, in my opinion, because when Harvey Heiss came back in 88, or during that time, he wanted to build a game called Baby in the Hole. So Kamiko got a staff of people, and they made it happen. They created it. But anytime, you know, Joe was involved with bringing speakers to Expo, he said, you know what, you need a good banquet speaker. And Joe would pay for these guys to come into the show. So it was a very interesting relationship at the time. Joe was like just one of the gang, you know. And
yeah.
Anything to do to help you out, and it was just amazing the support we had from them during the time.
Yeah, Joe always been one of my closest friends. I mean, let's say three weeks after I turned down a job to work for Joe at IGT, he was at my wedding. So, you know, he really wanted me to come work there, but Joe is and always will be a dear friend. So it's too bad he couldn't come to Expo this year, but I'm sure he'll be back. And we really love to support Expo, but even though most people hated the games, we tried to make games better for the for the enthusiasts. But there's always money and time and
There's one more thing I remember. Joe Camco, was a seminar called Design a Pinball Machine. And he would ask the audience, what do you want to see in it? Well, we want to see a ramp go up here, turn to the right, and have something spin around there. If I'm not mistaken, he actually tried to build the one game in his seminar.
Yeah, the Olympics.
Was it the Olympics or whatever?
Yeah.
I mean, only Joe would do this stuff. It's just unbelievable. Right. I mean, the money he spent out of pocket, or out of somebody's pocket.
And it's really funny now that Stern has gotten away from sort of the traditional kind of licenses that were doing when we were Dave East. That the games that people would always ask for in those design your own game seminars have been made.
Monopoly.
Elvis. Three Stooges hasn't been made. But those were always the three games that people would make. You know, we'd always say, well, you never could get the Elvis license. You never could get the Monopoly license. Well, it happened. So when I was hired, they asked, well, what game, if you wanted to design a game, what game would you design? I said, well, I'd do the Beatles. They're like, well, you'll never do that because you'll never get the license. But who knows? They did Elvis. So enough of them died, maybe they'll be able to get it. One question more.
What are you waiting for with the Three Stooges game?
I don't know. I don't work at Stern anymore. So,
you collectively in the business, but it sounds to me like a good idea.
Well, I just don't know that. The average 18 to 25 year old European is probably was the demographic when we were doing things. Of course, there's a lot more games sold to collectors now. I don't know if that would be a game that would sell or not. It's so far after the fact. I mean, I guess from Boomerang, my son knows who the robot Three Stooges are. But, all right.